The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. We'll begin today's program with articles from the Exploration issue of Smithsonian Magazine, which is the May 2018 edition. We'll start with an article titled "The Great Sino-Dino Boom" by Richard Conniff. A gold rush of fossil findings is turning China into the new epicenter of dinosaur research. Not long ago in northeastern China, I found myself being driven in a Mercedes-Benz SUV down a winding country road, trailed by a small motorcade of local dignitaries, past flat-roofed brick farmhouses and fields full of stubbled corn stalks. Abruptly, we arrived at our destination, and my guide, Fang Fang, slipped out of her high heels into fieldwork gear, pink sneakers with bright blue pom-poms on the Velcro straps. We were visiting a dinosaur dig, but there was also a museum under construction. Steel beams riveted together to form layers, stacked one atop another, climbing a hillside in two parallel rows. The two wings connected by a central pavilion looked like a bird about to take off. The new museum, its name roughly translates as Liaoning Baipiao Xietun Ancient Fossils Museum, is due to open sometime in 2019. It was unmistakably huge. It was also expensive. Fang Fang estimated $28 million for construction alone, and it was in the middle of nowhere. We were in a rural village called Xietun, about 250 miles northeast of Beijing. In the exuberant fashion of a lot of modern development in China, the new structure is going up in anticipation of visitors arriving by speed train from the capital, except that the speed train network hasn't been built yet. The new museum is located an epicenter of modern paleontological discovery, an area that is at least as rich in fossils and in some ways as wild as the American West during the great era of dinosaur discovery in the late 19th century. In the mid-1990s, on that hillside in Xietun, a farmer stumbled onto the world's first known feathered dinosaur, a creature now named Sinosauropteryx, the China dragon bird. Actually, the farmer found two halves of a slab, each preserving a mirror image of this dinosaur. In the free-willing spirit that has characterized the fossil trade in the area ever since, he sold one half to one unwitting museum and one half to another. It was the start of a fossil gold rush. The region has yielded more than 40 dinosaur species to date. Standing on a slope a few miles walk from the museum site, my guide pointed out the hills of a nearby farm where Euteranus, a 3,100-pound feathered dinosaur, turned up a few years ago. Think Tyrannosaurus Rex, but plumed like a Mardi Gras Indian. This was also the former home range of Anchiornis hexalil, a chicken-sized creature with enough preserved detail to become the first dinosaur ever described feather by feather in its authentic colors, an event one paleontologist linked to the birth of color TV. What has emerged from beneath the fields of Liaoning province and parts of neighboring provinces is, however, bigger than dinosaurs. A couple of decades of digging have uncovered two miraculously well-preserved ancient worlds. The first, called Yanliao Biota, is from the middle-late Jurassic period, 166 million years ago. The second, the J-hole Biota, is Cretaceous, from 131 million to 120 million years ago. The J-hole is more famous among paleontologists and far more diverse. Among the ancient biota, or plant and animal life, found so far, 4 turtle species, 8 amphibian species, 15 fishes, 17 mammals, 24 of the winged reptiles called pterosaurs, and no fewer than 53 ancient bird species. Taken together, these finds tell dramatic new stories about the dinosaur origin of birds and the evolution of feathers and flight. That's in addition to some of the earliest flowering plants, plus assorted pine, cypress, and ginkgo trees, algae, mosses, and ferns, snails, clams, crustaceans, insects, spiders, and almost endlessly onward. It's a measure of this diversity that, in addition to its other displays, the museum in Sihetun will house 26 different specimens, from fish to parrot-faced dinosaur called Pistaceroceros, all partly excavated but still embedded in the hillside where they were discovered. Here's another measure of that diversity. Liaoning already has at least 10 other fossil museums, some with important collections, others mainly products of local boosterism or bureaucratic career building. There's typically lots of money for constructing new buildings, less for acquiring collections, and none at all, at least in the provinces, for scientific staff to make sense of them. Many of the best specimens also turn up in Beijing, or at the Shandong Tianyu Nature Museum, 7 hours south of the capital, which one paleontologist described as, quote, the best place to see Liaoning fossils, unquote. One chilly December morning, a week into my trip, I looked out a hotel window into Chaoyang, a city of 3 million, about 45 miles west of Sihetun. The mist rose off a bend in the Daling River, and the sunrise lit up the mountains. Some say Chaoyang gets its name from an old poem about a mythological bird singing to the rising sun. It's known today as a city for fossils, and some of its most celebrated inhabitants are extinct birds. These fossils might not wow visitors whose idea of paleontology is limited to massive dinosaur reconstructions at other natural history museums. What Liaoning province typically produces are articulated skeletons in slabs of stone. I first saw one lying flat in a glass display case at the Beijing Museum of Natural History, too high off the ground for children to see, and often obscured for adults by lighting ingeniously positioned in precisely the wrong spots. Then I looked more closely. The backgrounds of the slabs, in mottled shades of beige, brown, and ochre, were like old monochrome watercolors, or like a landscape scroll painted in the Tang Dynasty. The fossils stood out against this background like bold strokes of calligraphy, and they were stunningly intact. It looks like somebody's chicken dinner, a friend remarked when I showed him a photo of one such fossilized bird. It looked, in truth, as if something had swatted the bird out of the sky and instantly entombed it in rock, which is more or less what happened over and over to vast numbers of such creatures across tens of millions of years. In the early Cretaceous era, northeastern China was mostly forest and lake country with a temperate climate, but it was prone to ferocious volcanic eruptions. Lake bed mud and volcanic ash quickly entombed victims without the oxygen necessary for decomposition. And these fine-grained sediments preserved not just bones, but also feathers, hair, skin tissue, organs, and even stomach contents. The Chaoyang native Microraptor, for instance, is a small, four-winged dinosaur, a tree dweller built for short predatory plunges from branch to branch. Researchers examining one specimen recently found evidence in its abdomen that its last meal was a bird swallowed nearly whole. They also identified the bird. A mammal called Rhipanomammus, resembling a modern bulldog, turned out to have eaten a small dinosaur. For paleontologists, the value of Liaoning fossils lies not just in the extraordinarily preserved details, but also in the timing, They've opened a window on the moment when birds broke away from other dinosaurs and evolved new forms of flight and ways of feeding. They reveal details about most of the digestive, respiratory, skeletal, and plumage adaptations that transform the creatures from big, scary, meat-eating dinosaurs to something like a modern pigeon or hummingbird. When I was a kid, we didn't understand those transitions, says Matthew Serrano, the curator of Dinosauria at Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. It was like having a book with the first chapter, the fifth chapter, and the last 10 chapters. How you got from the beginning to the end was poorly understood. Through the Liaoning fossils, we now know there was a lot more variety and nuance to the story than we have predicted. These transitions have never been detailed in such abundance. 150-million-year-old Archaeopteryx has been revered since 1861 as critical evidence for the evolution of birds from reptiles. But it's known from just a dozen fossils found in Germany. By contrast, Liaoning has produced so many specimens of some species that paleontologists study them not just microscopically, but statistically. That's what's great about Liaoning, says Jing Mai O'Connor, an American paleontologist at Beijing's Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology, IVPP. When you have such huge collections, you can study variation between species and within species. You can look at male-female variation. You can confirm the absence or presence of anatomical structures. It opens up a really exciting range of research topics not normally available to paleontologists. But the way fossils get collected in Liaoning also jeopardizes research possibilities. O'Connor says it's because it has become too difficult to deal with provincial bureaucrats who may be hoping to capitalize on the fossil trade themselves. Instead, an army of untrained farmers does much of the digging. In the process, the farmers typically destroy the excavation site without recording such basic data as the exact location of a dig and the depth or stratigraphic layer in which they found a specimen. Unspectacular invertebrate fossils, which provide clues to a specimen's date, get cast aside as worthless. As a result, professional paleontologists may be able to measure and describe hundreds of different Confuciusornis, a crow-sized bird from the early Cretaceous, but they have no way to determine whether individual specimens live side by side or millions of years apart, says Louis Chiap, who directs the Dinosaur Institute at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. That makes it impossible to track the evolution of different traits. For instance, Confuciusornis's toothless modern bird beak over time. In Chaoyang, late one afternoon, I visited a darkened, minimally heated apartment to find precious fossils stacked on every available surface. On the coffee table, next to some vitamin pills and a water bottle, was a 160-million-year-old Anchiornis. Its dinosaur tail and its plumy smudge of feathers preserved in exquisite detail. Nearby, the twin halves of a split fossil lay side by side, displaying a fish that now seemed to be perpetually swimming towards itself. A child's sparkle-painted pink bicycle stood on the balcony, and it occurred to me that the only way its owners could get to the front door would be by wheeling it through a treasure house of perfectly preserved life forms from scores of millions of years in the past. The apartment belonged to the child's father, a museum director, who was holding the specimens for the new museum at Sihetun. Liu Jukchang, a paleontologist visiting from the Chinese Academy of Geological Sciences, picked up a specimen from the floor and, pointing to different parts of the anatomy, said, "This part is real, this part is not." To me, the difference was indiscernible. But to Liu's eyes, it leapt out. I think someone went to find another specimen, cut a groove, and cemented in a suitable-looking wing bone. The museum, he said, would have a preparator remove the fake parts and preserve what's authentic. This kind of forgery is routine, and only a handful of Chinese experts can spot it with the naked eye. Other researchers rely on ultraviolet light, which reflects the light differently from fake and authentic sections of the same slab. It's just a fact, adds O'Connor, that most of the people buying these specimens are not scientists, or they are scientists with quotation marks. I'm constantly being shown a specimen by someone who says, you have to describe this. This is a gelhornis with a weird furnicula, that is a wishbone. She tells them it's actually a gelhornis with a furcula manually added. In the early days, she says, forgers actually painted feathers on some specimens. You do the water test and the feathers will come right off. Now they don't use water-soluble inks. Nevertheless, there's genuine fossil wealth being revealed in Liaoning. Many of the slabs have been transferred to Beijing, where preparators are getting them ready for display. One morning in the basement of the IVPP, I watched a young man stare through a dual lens of a microscope as he worked an air pressure tool along the length of a wing bone. The needle point-tipped wind and flecks of stone flew out to the sides, gradually freeing bone from matrix. Nearby, a woman used an old credit card to apply a tiny drop of 502 superglue to break in a fossil, then went back to work with a needle-like pick in one hand and an air pump in the other. Eight preparators were working at the moment at different fossils. It was an assembly line, dedicated to opening old tombs and bringing whole empires of unimaginably strange and beautiful creatures almost back to life. Next, we'll move on to an article titled The Sea Hunters by Joshua Levine from the prologue section of the magazine. A wreck-diving archaeologist and his search for a notorious German U-boat. You get an idea before you even walk in his door that Thomas Termote's life is bound up with the sea, or at any rate, what lies beneath it. Outside his house in Ostend, on the Belgian coast, stands the biggest anchor you've ever seen, over 16 feet high, weighing 5 tons. It was hand-forged for an old British man-of-war, and a trawler hauled it up from the seabed of the English Channel, a stone's throw from here. Out in the backyard, there's a creepy-looking mine from the First World War, about a foot in diameter and prickly all over with detonators. It, too, came from nearby waters. The Germans occupied the entire Belgian coast during World War I. Their U-boats were based farther inland in Bruges, just outside the range of British naval guns, and passed through canals that fed into the channel at Ostend and the nearby town of Zeebruges. The dunes outside Termote's house are still lined with concrete bunkers built by the Germans to defend its U-boat bases from British attack. It was mines like the one in Termote's backyard that sent more of Germany's World War I U-boats to the bottom of the channel than anything else. Termote started driving the icy English Channel at age 14 with his father, Dirk, a retired hotelier. Along the way, he picked up a degree in marine archaeology, a subject that barely existed when he started studying it, and has been studying wrecks around the world ever since. But the vast U-boat cemetery that starts just outside his front door is what he most loves to explore. To date, he has found the remains of 28 U-boats down there, 11 in Belgian waters. His book about U-boats, War Beneath the Waves, was published last year. One newspaper headline called him the Flemish Indiana Jones. Termote is a compact, broad-chested man, soft-spoken and amiable. For most of the year, he makes his living diving commercially around Belgian ports. Summer is for combing the local waters for wrecks, which are getting tougher to find all the time. The sea floor has been well mapped and picked over by now. Yet only last summer, Termote stumbled across his most important discovery yet. In the spring of 2017, Termote was checking Belgian Hydrographic Department documents online to see if any previously charted wrecks had shifted on the seabed. He took a passing look at one of these flagged wrecks just lying some 80 feet deep, about 12 miles straight off Ostend. She's been on the chart since 1947, says Termote. In the 1980s, she was identified as an upturned landing craft, like the ones in Saving Private Ryan, so it didn't sound very interesting. Modern multi-beam echo sounders, the sonar devices now used for hydrographic surveys, are far more sensitive than earlier technologies. Today you can almost see the links in an anchor chain. This was obviously not a landing craft. It wasn't shaped like a biscuit tin, but like a cigar, with two pointy ends and a tower in the middle. The surveys also give you length, and this was 26 or 27 meters. I was like, bloody hell, this has to be a submarine. The original faulty identification had almost certainly thrown other wreck hunters off the scent. It helped, too, that the sub lay in the middle of a shipping lane, further discouraging the curious. Every 15 or 20 minutes, you get 200-meter tankers passing over it. It would be like driving on a freeway. Since 2013, the governor of West Flanders, which includes Belgium's short seacoast, has been Carl de Kalwe. In addition to his other duties, de Kalwe is Belgium's receiver of wrecks, which means he has authority over anything found in Belgian territorial waters. He's another of Termoet's old friends, not to mention a maritime history buff. So when Termoet went down for the first time last June, maritime police were standing by and coastal radar had been alerted. A 1,000-foot exclusion zone had kept commercial shipping from the dive site. In the first half minute, I knew it was a German UB-2-class submarine, remembers Termoet. After 30 U-boats, you just feel it. I can't describe the elation I felt when I came up. Termoet made 6 dives that summer. The submarine was indeed a U-boat class 2 U-boat. Both periscopes had been bent forward. Swimming around the bow, Termoet saw that the top starboard torpedo tube had been twisted and ripped what must have been a massive explosion. UB-2 class subs had 2 tubes on each side, one on top of the other. Miraculously, given that it had been so violently sunk, the sub had escaped more extensive damage and was largely intact. Finding a U-boat in such a condition is unique, says Termoet. Most are heavily damaged, blown in two, or heavily salvaged. You won't find another like this. Still, the identification number painted on the conning tower was missing, corroded over time. At a press conference last September, when Belgian authorities announced the discovery, the sub's identity remained a mystery. In the absence of tower markings, the surest way to identify a U-boat is by its bronze propeller, often stamped by date and, if you're lucky, serial number. Termoet went down again and examined the U-boat's stern. The port side propeller had been sheared off. Termoet suspects it was lost when Belgian authorities had wire-dragged the sea down to 25 meters to make sure nothing sticking up at any higher could endanger local shipping. The starboard propeller was still there, but was made of iron and unmarked. The first time Termoet had found a U-boat with an iron propeller. By the end of 1916, U-boat crews knew they were on a suicide mission because the British had gotten so good at detecting and destroying U-boats, says Termoet. Why bother putting a nicer propeller on her? Termoet made a final dive before winter last November. To put a name to his U-boat, he hoped to match a number on the periscope with records from the optics supplier, Berlin's C.P. Goers. He did find the number, 417, but Goers's archives, he learned, no longer exist. On the dive, I started cleaning the torpedo tubes. You can find markings there, says Termoet. Clean, 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 and then this 10-centimeter plaque comes free. It says UB-29. I can't describe that feeling. UB-29 was based in the medieval town of Bruges as part of the Flanders Flotilla, Germany's English Channel fleet. The sub first took to sea in March 1916. At the helm was Herbert Pustekuchen, who was to become one of Germany's most deadly U-boat aces. Pustekuchen ranks 31st among 37 commanders who each sank over 100,000 tons of Allied shipping during World War I. For this, he won 2 Iron Crosses and the Royal House Order of Hohenzollern. Pustekuchen is best known not for the ships he sank, but for the one he didn't. On March 24, 1916, Pustekuchen sighted a cross-channel ferry, the SS Sussex, en route from Folkestone in England to Dieppe in France, with 325 passengers aboard. With no prior warning, UB-29 fired a torpedo from 1,400 yards, tearing off the ferry's bow. Lifeboats were lowered, but several capsized. At least 50 passengers lost their lives. The Sussex managed to stay afloat and was towed stern first to France. There were Americans on board the Sussex, and several were among the wounded. Pustekuchen had kicked a hornet's nest. Less than a year before, a German U-boat sank the liner Lusitania in the Irish Sea, and 128 Americans died. President Woodrow Wilson put Germany on notice that unrestricted submarine warfare, the shoot-first tactic the U-boat skippers took up after early losses, would bring the United States into the war. Now UV-29 had done it again, and Wilson threatened to break diplomatic relations. Cowed, Germany signed the Sussex Pledge. Henceforth, her U-boat captains would surface and search merchant ships for munitions. If armaments were found, the subcrew could sink the ship after allowing its merchant crew to board lifeboats. Passenger shipping would be spared. These were known in maritime law as cruiser rules. Reducing the effectiveness of U-boats now denied the surprise torpedo attacks. UB-29's last patrol came less than a year after it entered service, under a new captain, Erich Plascht. Herbert Pushtkuchen went down with his crew in June 1917, when his UC-66 was bombed by a Curtiss flying boat near England's Scilly Isles. The wreck was found in 2009. It was Plask's second time out. On December 13, 1916, UB-29 was spotted by the British destroyer HMS Landrail near the Strait of Dover. The Landrail managed to ram the sub before it could fully submerge. The destroyer dropped several depth charges over the side. The depth charge launcher had yet to be invented. UB-29 was never seen again. Around midnight, Landrail searchlights picked out oil and debris on the surface of the water. The weather was bad and the night was black. Landrail headed for home. In the absence of conclusive evidence, Landrail was never credited with an official kill, but the crew was awarded prize money anyway. English authorities marked the unseen grave of UB-29 southwest of the Goodwin Sands, 6 miles off the coastal town of Deal in Kent. By early 1917, the German High Command had concluded that it would be hard-pressed to win the war of attrition on the Western Front. Some 2 weeks after UB-29 went down, German Admiral Henning von Hötzendorf, in so many words, called for an end to the pledge if it had provoked and urged Germany to let U-boats fire at will. At a conference in the German town of Pless on January 9, 1917, the German High Command decided that unrestricted submarine warfare would commence February 1st. Here's what Termote thinks happened to UB-29. When the Landrail rammed the sub, the impact bent the two periscopes simultaneously, which is why he found them at the same angle. The depth charges wounded it and ruptured its oil tanks. But he argues UB-29 crawled away, slowly limping the 60 or so miles back home on compass. Plaskt and his 21 crewmen must have felt a wild elation. They were probably celebrating their escape. We're going to be home in an hour. We made it. Let's party. Drink champagne. And then boom. Termote suggests that UB-29 hooked a mine with one of its twisted periscopes, dragging it down directly onto its hull. UB-29's last moments must have been slow and horrible. You can see the damage is limited to the bow, so you can imagine that the people from the command center up to the engine room might still have been alive afterwards. It's not like the U-boats you find blown in half where everybody dies immediately, says Termote. As the water rose inside the hull, the crewmen may have cut short their inevitable agony by shooting themselves with their long-barreled service Lugers. Or they may have stuffed cotton in their mouths and noses and drowned themselves. Both were known to happen. Terrible, says Termote. However, they met their end. They lie with UB-29 steel walls, buried in the sand that has filtered through its cracks for 100 years. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.